I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last Saturday, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to impose tough new sanctions on North Korea for its missile and nuclear weapons testing program. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley introduced the resolution. A few days later, the Washington Post reported that the Defense Intelligence Agency had determined that North Korea had produced a miniaturized nuclear warhead that could fit inside a missile, quote, crossing a key threshold on the path to becoming a full-fledged nuclear power. President Trump, reportedly unbeknownst to his foreign policy team, said this on Tuesday.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson tried to calm global anxieties with these words, which are edited.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. So I think what the president was doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language.
The North Korean military called Trump's warning a load of nonsense and announced that it was in the final stages of a plan to fire four mid-range missiles to the waters off the coast of Guam, which is a U.S. territory home to three American military bases. We asked Robert Litvak to join us. He's director of international security studies at the Wilson Center, wrote a book called Preventing North Korea's Nuclear Breakout. He was also on the National Security Council staff during the Clinton administration. And Robert Litvak, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Did the president use language which Kim and North Korea understands?
Well, this week's escalating rhetoric brought to mind Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August about the drift of war in 1914. Presidential statements should be carefully calibrated to prevent misperception and miscalculation that could lead to inadvertent escalation. A worrisome trend is that we are not fully taking into account how our words and actions may be perceived in Pyongyang. For example, a move that we take, like an exercise of B-1B bombers from Guam, from our perspective, it's bolstering deterrence. But from the North Korean perspective, it could be viewed within the context of discussions about preventive military options in the United States as the prelude to a conflict. So we have to take this into account. I think it's time to de-escalate the rhetoric and pivot to serious diplomacy.
How do you de-escalate the rhetoric? And it does come from both sides. I think what's unusual is the rhetoric coming out of the president's mouth. But how do you de-escalate what's already been said?
Well, what's been said has been said. And pivoting to serious diplomacy in this current political environment will be very difficult. There was a suggestion from the administration that this was kind of a planned out strategy, that it was essentially a good cop, bad cop situation. And someone referred to a quote from Richard Nixon in 1972 about the madman theory, that is, that the possibility that the United States could lose control and that this would stimulate others, particularly China, to take action to address the situation. I think that's a very dangerous dynamic. And the notion that these mixed messages are part of a strategy, I think that the risk of misperception and miscalculation in this context, particularly dealing with an opaque society and an opaque decision-making process that we have in Pyongyang, is quite worrisome. And to pick up on a development that you addressed in your lead-in, really this cycle of escalated rhetoric got launched with the Security Council action over the weekend, and then the Washington Post report about the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency assessment that North Korea had mastered miniaturization of warheads, which is a pivotal step toward being able to credibly threaten the United States with a nuclear weapon. That said, North Korea is not all the way there. They have yet to perfect the reentry of a warhead. In their July 28th test, the reentry vehicle, the warhead burned up. That was detected by the Japanese. What that suggests is that there is time for diplomacy before North Korea attains this capability. The open question is whether a pivot to diplomacy is possible in this very tense political environment.
Well, the President Trump has said the end of strategic patience is over. That was really a policy of the Obama administration. But did that strategic patience get us to this point where it looks like North Korea is closer to having some kind of nuclear weapons?
Essentially, we have three options to deal with North Korea, and they've been much discussed. They're the same three bad options, which are bomb, negotiate, or acquiesce, and then contain and deter their capabilities. The notion underlying strategic patience is really not that different from the Trump's rubric, which is maximum pressure. That is, through the punitive impact of economic sanctions, North Korea would be brought to the negotiating table where it would negotiate constraints on its capabilities. Ideally, from the U.S. perspective, it would be full denuclearization. That is not a realistic diplomatic objective where we're at right now. You'll recall in the Iran nuclear negotiations, we were talking about constraining an emerging capability, a latent capability that they had from their ability to enrich uranium. North Korea has an arsenal estimated around 20 warheads. Mm. And the Kim regime views these nuclear weapons as a key deterrent to ensure regime survival. So zero is not an option. And really what I argue in my new publication, Preventing North Korea's Nuclear Breakout, is 20 is better than 100, which is the trajectory they're on right now in terms of numbers of warheads, and that we should try to negotiate constraints on their program through a freeze. There would have to be something in it for them. And I would just reiterate that zero is not a feasible diplomatic objective.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. You're saying we need to learn to live with a nuclear North Korea, maybe not with 100 nuclear warheads, but something less than that. You also said that they want this technology for defensive purposes. They are not a threat to their neighbors or the United States?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as not a threat to their neighbors. They did, North Korea did invade South Korea in 1950. I mean, they are a threat to their region. But let's put this nuclear program into context. It goes back decades. North Korea crossed the nuclear threshold in 2006 when it detonated a weapon, and has made steady progress with its ballistic missile program and now with miniaturization of warheads. So it has been a threat to Japan and South Korea for some years, and we've relied on deterrence and containment to address that threat. The novel development is that now, for the first time, the United States will be vulnerable to North Korean nuclear attack. Mm. And we're not there yet, but we're on the cusp of that threshold. And the United States, our own political culture, we don't do well with vulnerability. I mean, we've been vulnerable to the Soviet Union and Russia and China. North Korea would be the third adversarial state to be able to threaten the United States with a nuclear attack. And there you're back to the three bad options. The military option entails horrific potential risks of triggering a general war in the Korean Peninsula. I think that on current trajectory, by the end of the Trump administration's term, that the administration will have the choice between taking preventive military action, which some officials have alluded to, or just deterring this capability that the North Koreans are on the cusp of achieving.
You have described North Korea as a failed state on the verge of a nuclear breakout run by a dynastic cult. How do you negotiate, especially negotiate about nuclear weapons, with a dynastic cult?
Well, just to unpack that, I mean, the failed state with nuclear weapons.
That's kind of scary.
Northeast Asia is the most dynamic economic region in the world, and it's a region with a $1.3 trillion South Korean economy, a $4 or $5 trillion Japanese economy, and a 12-plus trillion-dollar Chinese economy. By contrast, the GDP of North Korea, which is not easy to calculate because of the barter nature of their economy and the availability of statistics, has been placed at a paltry $40 billion.
Wow.
Now, that's the size of a medium-sized U.S. city. I went to Wikipedia. It's about the size of Dayton, Ohio.
Wow.
So imagine a country with the economic capacity of a single medium-sized city, but with a nuclear arsenal, which on current trajectory could be one-half the size of Great Britain's, about 100 nuclear warheads by the year 2020. These are estimates. When I got into this business, I couldn't have conceived of North Korea having a nuclear arsenal approaching half the size of Great Britain. And as I stated in my previous response, you know, zero is not an option. We're not going to roll this program fully back as long as the Kim regime is in power. They are, I described it as a dynastic cult. I think the cult of personality for the family is remarkable, and that's a fair characterization.
Mm-hmm.
I do not characterize them as essentially being an irrational, crazy state. There is a rationality at work. The centerpiece of that rationality is their paramount objective of regime survival. We have to understand that and to take that into account in our negotiations, that in the first instance, zero, getting them to go to zero is not an option in the wake of the regime takedowns by the United States in Iraq in 2003 and Libya in 2011. They're not going to go to zero given this history. Second, the North Koreans have invested heavily in their program. They are going to retain this minimum deterrent, but it is not clear that they have a strategic imperative to build up to this very high level that they are on the trajectory to do.
And let me just jump in here. Almost no time left, but if they do strike, send these missiles, and they land off the waters of Guam, which is a U.S. territory, what should the U.S. do?
Well, I think that dynamic of testing I think it's of a kind with the risk of kind of excessive rhetoric, military deployments and actions that could be perceived differently. I think that I don't think we're fully in a Guns of August situation, but mm-hmm. It is a bad dynamic when you have heightened rhetoric, no communication, a history of distrust, an inability to perceive how the other is sort of making its decisions, and then a provocative military action like a ballistic missile launch landing in the waters near Guam. It's no accident they're focused on Guam, because that's where U.S. heavy bombers are based, other military assets that would be used in any preventive military contingency with North Korea.
You know, I hate to end on this note, but we do have to do that. Robert,
have a nice weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. I there was so much more to talk about. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Robert Litvak, Director of International Security Studies at the Wilson Center, wrote a book, Preventing North Korea's Nuclear Breakout. I'm Marty Moscowen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There are millions of job openings in this country, a phenomenon that's been referred to as a skills gap. Employers complaining they can't find workers with the requisite abilities and qualifications to fill those positions. Now, I ran across this headline, Wanted, Qualify People Who Will Work for Yesterday's Wages, saying the so-called skills gap problem could be solved with higher pay and a bigger investment in training and educating employees. Today, we want to take a deeper look into the skills mismatch, especially with an unemployment rate of 4.3%. That's according to the latest Labor Department figures. Also talking about how to train for the jobs of the future. And we have two guests who have joined us. Carl Van Horn is director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development, also distinguished professor of public policy at the Edward J. Blaustein School of Planning. That's at Rutgers University, author of a number of books, including Working Scared and the Lost Decade. I should say he just hosted a town hall on reskilling the mid-career workforce. Carl Van Horn, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Dean Baker. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He writes about economic reporting on his Beat the Press blog. He's also the author of Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Dean Baker, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499, especially if you think we are talking about you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dean Baker, let me start with these unemployment numbers, and I know they don't tell the whole story, but who are the unemployed in today's America?
Well, disproportionately, they're who they always are, African-Americans. Hispanics tend to be unemployed at higher rates. People with less education tend to be unemployed at higher rates. Also, teens, particularly if you combine African-American teens, their unemployment rate's somewhere around 24%. So basically, you know, if you think of who's not doing well in America, you know, those are the ones who are most likely to be unemployed. It is important to point out 4.3 sounds pretty good as an unemployment rate. That's right. The lowest it's been. We had it in May also, but lowest it's been since 2001. But many of us have been focusing on the employment rate, the percentage of prime age workers, people 25 to 54. So these are not retirees, the percent who are employed. And we're still down by about 1.5 percentage points from where we were before the recession. And if we use 2000 as a benchmark, we're still down by more than 3 percentage points. Mm-hmm. So for many of us have been saying the unemployment rate is not a good measure right now of labor market tightness, that there's still a lot of slack in that labor market.
So how many people do you think we're talking about, or what numbers should we use instead?
Well, again, I look at the employment rate for prime age workers. So, you know, I think it's implausible. And again, economists argue over this. It's a big debate. But I think it's implausible that so many people who are working, wanted to work back in 2007 or again in 2000, suddenly don't want to. And again, people talk about the skills. You go, well, they had the skills. The economy has not changed that much in a relatively short period of time. So I look to, you know, getting back to the employment rates that we had. Again, I would use 2000 as a target. I mean, mm-hmm. people look at that and say that was a really good year, and it was. But we should strive for really good years.
Well, Carl, let me get you in on the conversation. And as I mentioned, you hosted this town hall about reskilling the mid-career workforce. Do you think there's a skills gap in this country?
Well, I think the term skills gap suffers from being repeated so often that it's lost its meaning, because essentially when people talk about it, they really mean very different things. What's more important is to think about the basics of supply and demand. You know, where are people able to get jobs, and for how much are they being paid? And that's where some of the problems are. There clearly are specialized skills that are not being, jobs that are not being filled, mainly in the tech sector, but also in some specialized trades, especially in certain areas of the country. And this always happens. But the idea that it's universal, that it's every single place in the country, is, of course, a gross misstatement. Back to the other point you made, however, that talking about what we should look at.
Yes.
I think in addition to looking at some of the things Dean mentioned, we also need to focus on the long-term unemployed. We still have a very large number of people as a percentage, still higher than the pre-recession numbers. The folks have been out of work for at least 6 months. And then, of course, we also have a large number of people who dropped out of the labor force entirely. And then last, we have folks who are working part-time but really need a full-time job, or say they want a full-time job, the involuntary part-time worker. So it's not just about how many people are actually in and out of that number, that top-line number, but it's these other folks that we need to think about.
Well, let me ask you both, actually, about this quote, skills gap, and I hear you both being critical, but I did run across a survey, something like 34% of U.S. companies said, quote, that talent scarcity is their most pressing issue. Let me toss this first to you, Dean Baker. Are employers being overly fussy or overly demanding? If they are saying we want people with certain talents and skills and we cannot find them, how do you deconstruct that?
Yeah, I would say this is really a question that they aren't interested in paying for them, because, mm-hmm. you know, the biggest measure, you know, this is a market. If something's scarce, we expect to see the price rise. And there's very few occupations, jobs, where you could identify rapid wage increases. Again, I'm sure we could find some narrow categories. Carl mentioned some tech positions. I'm sure that's true. But, you know, broader areas of the economy, you just don't see rapidly rising wages. And, I've had some back and forth with people, and they go, well, it wouldn't do any good because the workers aren't there. My response is always go, sure, the workers are there. They're working for your competitor. So you're very hard-pressed to find a story where you're saying, okay, I need this or that skill. And you go, okay, maybe there's no one unemployed with that skill. I'll grant that's at least a possibility. But your competitors have some people with that skill. Why don't you bid them away? Mm. And we're just not seeing that. The wage growth has actually slowed in aggregate the last 6 months. It's about 2.2% annual rate these days. That's pretty slow. We're over 3% back in 2006, 2007. So I'm really hard-pressed to see the evidence that they're having a hard time finding workers. One other point I'll just mention that I won't take all the time here, but you should also expect to see some rise in the average work week. So again, here you are sitting there as an employer. You go, I'd really like to hire someone with skill X, but I can't find more people. Well, I already have some people with skill X. Why aren't I working those people more hours? And there's been a small decline. I won't make a big point of it, but there's been a small decline in the average work week. There has definitely not been an increase. And again, you look at that by industry, there probably is some industry somewhere, but you don't see this increase in this length of the average work week that you'd expect if employers were really having a hard time finding workers with the right skill.
Carl, are employers who are complaining about this talent scarcity, are they looking for the perfect worker, the worker that has all the talents and skills that they need ready-made, and then they want to hire them?
Yes. I mean, partly what we see is employers have gotten more picky over time, and that is a function of, I think, a couple of things. First, it's the legacy of the Great Recession. So during the Great Recession, at its worst point, there were 7 job seekers for every 1 opening. Now it's close to 1-to-1. A lot of employers have not gotten over those, in a sense, those opportunities they had back then. The other factor is just the introduction of automatic tracking systems, which make it very easy to process millions and millions, literally, of applications, and to add qualifications that they may or may not need, that, again, they'd like to be able to find, but they don't find them. So then they say, well, we're not finding people. So it's in addition, you also have the slowdown of the hiring process that is a function of background checks and people looking for social media comments. There's all sorts of things that have intervened in the hiring process that we weren't considering 15, 20 years ago. Now, having said all that, I think it is important to point out there are skills problems or shortages in certain areas. I think about primary care physicians in rural areas. There clearly are not enough doctors, and you can't just turn them out or hire them from someone else. Dean's right. I mean, you can certainly poach from other people. You can train up your own workers. But in some cases, there literally are shortages. So it's what we call a spatial mismatch, or people are not in the right place. Or let's say you need someone to teach physics in high school. They're not easy to find because there's constraints on what a public school system, for example, can pay for a physics teacher or an advanced math teacher. So it's not that there are no shortages. It's just that when we talk about these surveys that say 40% of people say there's a shortage, that's where I have a problem. I think that's an exaggeration.
Well, and then things like background checks. I was reading that some employers looking to hire people, I'll put this to you, Dean, they didn't hire because so many people could not pass a drug test. Is that an issue for today's employer?
It is. I mean, employers, many of them do give drug tests, and obviously we have a lot of people with drug issues, so there are a lot of people testing positive. And I guess there are 2 points. I mean, again, drugs are a problem. How do you deal with that? That's not an easy story. But the other question is, you know, what drugs are these people doing? Is that going to create a big problem on the job? You know, and again, I'm not being cryptic here. I mean, obviously we don't want someone who's got a heroin problem or whatever driving a truck. I mean, you could think of all sorts of things where, yes, you do not want this. But there are cases if someone occasionally smokes marijuana. In some states, of course, marijuana is legal. And you have a job that doesn't outwardly, you know, that create any problem. Again, you don't want the person to have smoked on the job, but you know, if they, you know, they go home at night and they smoke marijuana, does that mean they can't the next day work as a retail clerk? You know, on the face of it, that wouldn't seem to be a problem. So there may be cases where employers are using this as a screening device, and I could understand that they might prefer to have someone who doesn't have any drug history, doesn't use drugs, but you know, if it's the case that, you know, look, you really want to hire someone and you have someone who seems otherwise a good worker, but they do smoke marijuana recreationally, maybe they have to hire that person.
Carl, let me go back to you. You did just host this town hall this week about the reskilling of the mid-career workforce. And I'm assuming you're talking about people that perhaps have been out of the workforce. They're in middle age, maybe 40s or 50s. They maybe haven't worked for a year or two. Are those the people that were part of your discussion?
Yes. I mean, we are run a program here that's funded privately to help long-term unemployed older workers get back in the labor market. And we're serving nearly 3,000 people right now. And the average age of that group is 56 years old. They've been out of work for about 2 years on average. Now, their problem is twofold. One is they often don't have one kind of skill, which we don't talk often enough about, and that is the skill of how to look for a job. So in other words, they have not been in the labor market looking. They were working, so they didn't have to look for a job. And now suddenly they're out of work, and they've lost that understanding about how the labor market works. So partly that we talked about that, just helping people understand that. The other point is helping people understand which kinds of skills that you can acquire online or at a college, university, or a technical school are actually in demand. And that's another piece here which is important to mention. There's not a lot of good information out there for people. In many ways, there's a confusing set of information about, well, what should I take? So a lot of people spend money on education and training that really doesn't have a labor market analog, that it's sold by somebody, a private or even a public school, but they actually are not getting a skill that's going to be useful in the workplace. So a lot of it is really helping people understand more about that and also transitioning more to what we call work-based learning, where people are working, learning a job on the job that is actually in demand.
Dean, one of the arguments I've heard, which is that if you're looking for work and there isn't work where you live, then go move somewhere else. Does that make sense? And how realistic is that?
Well, it makes some sense. I mean, you have to think about this seriously. It really depends on a person's situation. It depends on what their job prospects would be elsewhere. So you do have some areas, you know, we could point to Appalachia where it's had high unemployment for years. And, you know, it's not likely to turn around. It's not likely that we're going to, I mean, I know President Trump's talking about bringing back coal. But, you know, if I were an unemployed coal miner in West Virginia, I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. Those jobs are not going to come back. So do you tell that worker, well, you should go somewhere else? If someone's young, they don't have strong family ties, you know, they don't have a spouse who has a job, they don't have kids in school, that might well be very good advice. And, of course, people have done that. I mean, I remember I was growing up in Chicago. We had a huge number of kids. Their parents were from Appalachia. You know, they'd moved there. And, of course, you know, you had the huge migration of African Americans from the South to, you know, the northern cities immediately following World War II. So it's not as though people never move for jobs. They do. But to envision that that's something very easy and we could just say, oh, you don't have a job there, just go move, you know, 300 miles away, 600 miles away, wherever it might be, that's not an easy thing to do. And again, there's not a guarantee in many cases that there's a job waiting for you at the other side. So you have to, it's a reasonable point. People often have and continue to move for jobs, but we have to think it's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, good policy question, how can you make that easier where it does make sense?
Carl, we have a tweet from Helga. She says, single mothers, childcare is non-existent in this country, raising the point about whether we just make it too hard for people, especially for parents of young children, to work.
That's a good point. And that's actually, again, one of these issues about how do employers tap into untapped markets, right? So one way is to pay people more money, as we've obviously been talking about, but it also is to provide other ways to get them in the labor market. And it may be providing daycare on site or subsidizing daycare for young children. Other strategies in terms of getting a labor market that is, let's say, too far away is to provide subsidies for them to travel. One of the things we find in New Jersey, for example, is a lot of the pharmaceutical industry located itself on suburban campuses in our state. And guess what? Millennials don't want to go to those and live in those areas. So what the pharmaceutical companies do is they bus people from Jersey City and Hoboken out to the suburban campuses to work and back, right? So that's how they adjusted their labor market problem, because they weren't getting them immediately in their communities like they did 25 years ago.
Let me read an email from Daniel. I'll toss this to you, Dean. He says, he's an electrician, small business owner. He says, while I don't have a problem hiring older electricians, it's incredibly difficult to find younger electricians to hire. That's a very specific industry, obviously, but from his perspective, he's got some kind of an employment problem looking for people, but he can't find them.
That's an interesting issue. You know, I can't speak for the electrician's craft. I mean, it's a skilled craft, relatively well-paying. It's something that the U.S., I'll just say, as a matter of national policy, I think we've been somewhat neglectful. So this is not something we typically need a college education for, but it is skills. I mean, this is not something that someone could just, you know, walk in there and in a few days pick up the work, at least not for a skilled electrician. So I think we have been neglectful. Now, you do have a number of union training programs, many of which were pretty good. I mean, it does vary. You know, some of those were pretty good. I can't speak to the current state of them. But, you know, other countries, you know, Germany is one that, you know, we often highlight here. They have very, very good apprenticeship programs where people do develop skills. You know, these are non-college educated people, but these are very skilled workers. And that's the sort of thing, you know, at least I think would be great to try to emulate here. I mean, it's not that you could switch overnight and we'll have German labor markets. But I think having, you know, paths where students, you know, they're not going a college education path, but nonetheless are getting a skill that, you know, typically will mean a pretty good living standard over their lifetime.
And that's Dean Baker. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He writes about economic reporting on his Beat the Press blog, wrote a book called Rigged. Also with us, Carl Van Horn, director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development, also distinguished professor of public policy at the Edward J. Blaustein School of Planning at the at Rutgers University. He, too, has written some books, including Working Scared and the Lost Decade. We're talking about the so-called skills mismatch, how to find work, and what the future of employment will be. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Companies often complain they have job openings. Why? Because they can't find workers with the skills to fill them, often called the skills gap. But some people say this idea is both overblown and misleading. We're talking a bit about the skills mismatch in the U.S. workforce, how to get more workers employed, and certainly how to prepare them for the jobs of the future. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. And I see calls coming in. RadioTimes@WHYY.org is the email address, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Lisa from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Actually, I have a quick comment. You were just talking about an apprenticeship program, and we're actually working in Chester County to bring in an apprenticeship program specifically for electricians to our high schools.
Great.
So we'll be doing a presentation on that. But my question was actually something different. So the question I had was, I never hear anyone talking about lowering the retirement age, and that would really open up millions of jobs, and it could easily be funded if we started to tax passive income, made that Social Security taxable. So I'm just curious what your guests think of that.
Me too. Lisa, thanks for calling in. Carl, can I toss that first to you?
Yes. Actually, the trend in the policy community actually in Washington and so on is to increase the retirement age because of the Social Security trust fund issues in the long run. So I wouldn't predict that's likely to happen. The other point I'd make is that most Americans don't have enough savings that they can afford to retire, more importantly, regardless of what the policy signals are. And survey after survey show that baby boomers actually want to stay in the labor market, not only because they need the money, but also because they believe, and they're right, the evidence on this, that it's probably healthy for them to continue to work if they can. So although that might be an appealing solution in some countries, I don't think that's likely to happen in this country.
Dean, do we have too few jobs?
I don't think we have too few jobs. Well, I shouldn't say that. Today, we have too few jobs. I don't think we're condemned to having too few jobs because we know how to create jobs. But I do think this issue of retirement age, you know, again, I agree with Carl said. I mean, certainly a lot of people are going, we should raise it. I don't agree with that. And we are raising it. I mean, I should point that out, that for getting the normal Social Security benefit, it's currently 66 and it will rise to 67 over the next 5 years, I believe it is. So we have raised that. And, you know, so we have been going the other way. And there's many people who are saying we should push it up to 70, point being people are living longer. I'm not in that camp. But the point I'll make that I think is important, and this gets back to the healthcare debate that we've been having here in Washington, there are a lot of people, say in their 60s, who are working not necessarily because they need the money, but because they need healthcare insurance. And one of the great things about the Affordable Care Act, at least from my view, was that it gave people the opportunity to get insurance outside of employment. And we actually did see a very large rise, the increase in voluntary part-time employment. So these are people who tell the Bureau of Labor Statistics that they want to work part-time. So the increase in voluntary part-time employment was about a little over 2 million between 2013, when the exchanges first went into effect at the beginning of 2014, and the most recent data. So that, I think, is, you know, really shouldn't be a contentious issue. So in other words, we're just saying, you know, some people would rather not work or they'd rather work part-time, but they feel the need to work because they need health care insurance, and that's the only way they can get it. So if we could let people get health care insurance outside of employment, that's a great thing.
Carl, let me ask you something else, and this having to do with the relationship between employers and employees back in the olden days. I don't know exactly how true this was, but someone would get a job, let's say out of high school or college, and they might stay on that job for decades until their retirement. That seems to be changing with the gig economy and just some of the uncertainties in the economy. Has that changed the relationship between workers and employers so that an employer might not want to train somebody because they might be gone in 5 years and there goes their investment?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, clearly most jobs today are not likely to last with the same firm because the firm may not be there in a year or two or 6 months. So they can't count on being there, and nor can the worker count on staying with that firm. And that has certainly somewhat increased the likelihood of employers to say, well, let's have the training responsibility pushed back to the job seeker, to the student, to the person who's applying, as opposed to them supplying the jobs. Back when I graduated from college, for example, many, many years ago, there were all kinds of management trainee positions where an individual would start with a firm, spend a year or two learning the trade, learning the business, and then eventually be a fully productive worker. That's clearly not what employers do now. That doesn't mean they don't train their workers, but they don't have that slow onboarding process. So what it means is that people have to be their do-it-yourself trainer for themselves. They have to learn how to navigate this labor market and always have their eye out for how to train up so they can be successful. The problem is most of our public policies do not support that. We put most of our money in this country into the first 23 years or so of life. And after that, you're pretty much on your own. There's just not a lot to support you. So this is a major policy change which would help both workers and, frankly, employers if we put a bigger effort into supporting people to train. And by the way, on the part of the voluntary part-time worker, that's part of that virtuous cycle. A person can have their health care, work part-time, and study, go to school, learn more skills so they can be successful in the future.
Dean, you mentioned earlier that we are not seeing the wages increase based on the kind of supply and demand policy. Why is that? Why have wages been depressed for so long?
Well, 2 points. I mean, Carl raised this issue earlier that, you know, during the recession, I mean, the labor market was so weak that I think employers really just got out of the habit that, you know, they had their choice of workers. Why would you ever raise wages? As it has gotten tighter, I just think they don't see that as an option for whatever reason. And again, if it's really the case that you're being held back, you know, here it is, you're a manufacturer and you have more orders than you know what to do with, you would think that you'd go, okay, well, then I have to pay workers more to get them. But we just don't see that happening, or at least not on a large scale. You know, again, it's one of these things because I always have someone go, well, I raised wages.
Yeah.
Surely that's happening. But, I mean, we're looking at aggregate data. So, you know, we have a workforce of 150 million people. So we're saying, okay, is this showing up in aggregate? And clearly it's not. So I think it's just a case where employers, you know, they're very reluctant to raise wages. And, you know, they need kind of a kick. Neil Kashkari, who's the president of the Minneapolis Fed, was at a business meeting of business people 2 days ago. And he asked some question. I don't know exactly how he posed it. Do you have problems getting labor? And many of them raised their hand. And then he goes, how many of you plan to raise wages in the next 2 years?
And
they said, very few. So he said, if you're not raising wages, then don't tell me you have a labor shortage. You're just whining.
So it is supply and demand, thinking about wages and employment.
Yeah, you know, and again, we all want to pay, you know, think of our rent, think of our mortgage, think of when you buy a car. We'd all rather pay less than more. And businesses, obviously, they'd rather pay less for their workers. But if you can't get the workers you need, then the answer is, well, then you better look to pay more.
Let me see what Marty from Allentown has to say. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times. Hi there, Marty. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. What I was thinking was, really, my experience has been that recently, in the last year and a half, that a lot of employers are requiring is a master's degree. And I'm 54 years old. I've got 12 credits toward a master's, but I don't really have the time, or I'm not sure whether or not I want to finish my master's. And that really seems to be a sticking point. I've got almost 30 years of experience in you know, a variety of industries, but I seem to encounter opposition with this, you know, the fact that I don't have a master's.
And Marty, just
and sometimes it doesn't even seem to matter what the master's is in.
Well, I was going to ask you, a master's in what?
I'm a little concerned, and I'm wondering whether or not I need to go back and finish that.
Well, it's an interesting question. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Carl, what do you think? We weren't able to find out what her master's degree would be in, but she seemed to be saying just a master's degree seemed to be one of the requirements for employment.
It's part of, a larger trend of what I call the recession legacy, which is during the recession, a lot of employers went through education and skills inflation. So they said, okay, we know there's a big labor market of people who can't find jobs, so we're just going to ask for more. And we'll get the person with a master's degree that we used to get with just a bachelor's degree, and we'll pay them less money and so on and so forth. And that's been documented in lots of ways. Unfortunately, for a lot of those people that took those jobs, they took it at a lower pay, and it's going to take them a long time to recover. Maybe ever, that they'll finally get back to where they should have had they started in a stronger labor market. And it cascaded. You know, when you had people with bachelor's degrees taking jobs that previously a person with a high school degree would take, and so on and so forth. Now, the issue that she's raising, which is a really tough one for a person in the prime working years, is will there be a return on investment if I go through this process of getting a master's degree? And frankly, that's a really tough decision not to make, because in many cases, what we see is people undergo that additional education and training. They have an opportunity cost. They're out of the labor market. They're paying for tuition and whatever. And then they go back into the labor market, and they can't get a job because the employer says, well, you don't have any experience in this field.
Oh, gosh.
So you have to be very careful about making that kind of decision, especially one that's long-term. Short-term training, a little different, can take the risk. And that's why it's better if you can connect to a specific program that has a very good track record of placing people into a job after you get the skills training.
Good luck to you, Marty. Dean, let me get Vito on. I'll give you a chance to respond to his comment. And Vito, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I'm an adjunct at a couple of colleges. And I had a question about jobs that have greater skills, where there's a clear demand. So in academia, for example, there's more demand. There's more people going to college than ever, but 50% of the workforce is part-time. Why is it that employers that require greater skills continue to create part-time jobs when there's a clear demand for full-time jobs? And I'll take my answer
sure.
off of there.
And Vito, and to you, Dean, we've done several shows about the plight of adjunct professors. Anything you want to say back to Vito?
Well, you know, I know adjunct professors are often, I'd like to think of a better term than exploited, but exploited because basically, you know, many schools see that there's a lot of people who can teach a class, two classes, and they see them as kind of disposable workers. And as a result of that, the pay is often very low and often with few benefits. So that's an unfortunate situation. I don't have any easy remedies for that. I mean, some places they've unionized have been able to get better conditions, and where you could do that, I think that's great, but obviously it's difficult to unionize, I know that. But in terms of the question of part-time and full-time, it's actually striking. I mean, part-time employment has gotten a bad name. You know, I understand that a lot of people need full-time work and can only find part-time. It's roughly 5 million. I should know the exact number, but it's in that ballpark, and that's not a small number. But the number of people who choose to work part-time, and again, people go, how do you know? Well, that's what they say. The Bureau of Labor Statistics goes, how many hours were you working? If you're less than 35, they count that as part-time. And then they say, they ask you a list of reasons. Why were you working less than 35 hours? And one option is you could only get part-time work. But the other options are, well, you're caring for kids or, you know, you're doing other things. And about 22 million people answer they chose to work part-time. So I think people choosing to work part-time, having that as an option, I mean, that's great. You have people that are going to school, they're caring for kids, they have an unhealthy family member, or maybe they only have to work 25 hours a week, and that, you know, maybe they're in their early 60s, they have savings, and they could get by on that. That's a great thing. I don't think people have to work 40 hours a week. So it is a big problem that people who need a full-time job can't get it. That's a very big problem. We have around 5 million people in that boat. But most of the people who are working part-time do choose it. And, you know, again, that's a great thing. For the people who need full-time jobs, again, obviously employers are going to try to get away with paying as little as possible in wages. And part of the story often with part-time is they'll give full-time workers benefits like health care insurance and a pension or at least a 401k, whereas part-time workers don't get that benefit. And, again, that's something that is a matter of concern. If we could get at least benefits prorated so that, you know, if you get a health care policy working 40 hours a week, you get the employer paying half if you're working 20. I mean, that's what I would like to see.
Sure, sure. Carl, almost out of time here, but I'm curious about, as you look into your crystal ball, of the jobs of the future. I mean, what kind of skills either high school or even middle schoolers or even college people are going to be training for? Is there any way to know in 10 years what are going to be the jobs that are going to be looking for people to do them?
Since you gave me a short time, the answer is no.
No.
There is no way to know. But,
right. I hear
but
you.
I would say this, that in all seriousness, that you can certainly benefit by training and education in general. The certainly the long arc of our development of our economy is that we're a highly skilled economy, and having more skills, especially basic skills, is very important in technological skills. Be careful, though, of the we think of the movie The Graduate, where Dustin Hoffman's uncle said plastics, you know, that's what you need to go into, where you have someone who says this is the answer. Be skeptical. Think more broadly about the training in skills that can be portable in a variety of different ways, because it's very hard to predict the labor market. It's harder than ever before.
And Dean, do people skills count for anything these days?
Well, they do. They certainly count for a lot. And, you know, Carl had earlier made the point about people not having the skills needed for looking for work. And, you know, this might sound silly, and in a lot of ways it is silly, but, you know, I've been on the other side. I'm sure Carl has too, you know, where we're hiring people. And, you know, how someone presents themselves matters. I mean, you want to think, okay, is this person, here's the job I need them for. Are they going to be good at the job? But there's no two ways about it. You know, someone comes in there, and I should point out, this often gets into racism and sexism because, you know, people have done a number of studies where you have a black woman come in there and be just like the white man, and people don't think as highly of them. So I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying that's the reality.
Well, we are ending on that note. Dean Baker, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research wrote a book called Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. Carl Van Horn, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development, also distinguished professor at the Public Policy Program at the Edward J. Blaustein School of Planning, and that's at Rutgers University. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.